I'm Ken Hemmings, and he is Chris Lang, and welcome to another of these regular property briefings. Again, a warm welcome to you, Chris.
Good to be with you again.
Whenever you read about the sale of a commercial property in the media, the article generally quotes a selling yield as well as the price. Obviously, different property types have different benchmark selling yields. But are there any reasons why you might be prepared to accept less than that?
Yeah, look, in the past, and let me just perhaps recap on what we might have covered earlier. Your selling yields, and we're generalising here and it depends on the market, but over time, industrial property, you'll generally buy it on a yield of 8 to 9%. Offices, 7 to 8% yield, and retail in the 5 to 6% yield. Now, sure, you'll see retail properties sell, on 3.5% yields, but they're generally prime retail, top tenant, long lease, or the rent is below market and therefore the yield reflected is not a market yield. But generally in those ranges. Now, so the question is, why would you be prepared to accept a lower yield? And on the face of it, there's no apparent logic as to why you would do that. But unless, of course, the lease is short term, and it may well be that you as an investor are also an occupier and have decided that this particular premises, be it retail or office or industrial, ideally suits your business profile, and it may be that you're buying it in your super fund or another investment company and you are going to become the tenant to occupy and lease the premises from the other entity. So therefore, to some degree, you may be prepared to pay above the market and therefore reflect a lower than market yield based on the rental of the current tenant, which, as I said, may be expiring over the next 6 to 12 months. But you have a very good reason for buying it. And alternatively, you may own the property next door. And I'm talking, in this case, perhaps maybe retail. And the adjoining property comes up for sale. Well, given that you might have bought the property 4 or 5 years ago, you are in a position to pay perhaps a bit more than anybody else, because what you will do in your books is effectively average the price of the two properties, and therefore overall it becomes a relatively reasonable purchase. You might have paid a bit much for one, but averaging it over it becomes quite a legitimate purchase. The initial low rent is not the most important aspect, because you have a different strategic reason for purchasing it. However, not every sale will have a special value to the purchaser. And more often, the reason for accepting a lower yield is that, as I mentioned at the outset, that the rental is too low. There's a pending review coming up, and your research shows you that you can achieve a significant, and when I say that, it's not just a CPI adjustment, we're talking a 5 or 10, sometimes even a 20% increase in the rental based on what's happening around. And if this tenant doesn't want to pay the increase in rental, well, you know that you can find a tenant who will. So in that case, the actual selling yield, while it appears below market, is irrelevant, because relative to what market rent is, the price you pay is in line with market as far as the yield is concerned. Now, the other reason why you might accept a low yield is that you have a very strong tenant and a long lease. And from your perspective, and it might be you're buying it for your super fund, if you can secure, say, an 8 to 10 year lease, you might be quite comfortable paying slightly above the market in price and therefore accepting slightly below the market in yield, because of the security and comfort of knowing that the tenant's not going to go broke and you have that cash flow going forward for the next 8 to 10 years. So that's another reason why you might be prepared to accept a lower yield. The third one would be that the property actually has redevelopment potential and has a relatively short-term lease. Now, I'm not necessarily talking 6 to 9 months. It might well be 3 years. But your research shows you that this property has potential to add considerable value. Now, whether you do it, and this is, I'm talking through development here, and development may be adding on another floor or two, it might be demolishing the building, whatever it is. What you need to do then is over that 3 year period is that you apply for and obtain the best possible town planning permit and building permit to create a structure that considerably enhances the value of the property. Now, as I said, you may or may not end up building it, but that's not important. I mean, if you want to go ahead and build it, you have to then, you become a developer. Now, sure, there's two things. There's profit and risk. Now, the profits are legitimate. The risk is something that is estimated by the developer. But bear in mind, in most cases, you will not be a seasoned developer. So therefore, you need to actually allow a bit more risk because things are likely to go wrong that you don't even know about. And we've discussed that, I think, in an earlier podcast. So the best way to tackle it is to get the permit, because getting the necessary town planning and building permit approvals can take anywhere from 6 to 12 months, sometimes longer if you have to go to appeal because the council causes you grief. You got to go to VCAT. And there's a time and a cost element in getting the permit. So while it might cost you, let's say, another $50,000 or $80,000 to get a permit to develop the site, that will be recouped when you sell it. But you have saved a time and uncertainty for the next purchaser who knows that they have a 6 to 9 to 12, maybe 18-month period where they have to settle on the property. At the time the tenant leaves and you want to sell it for the development site, it might be earning no income. While you own it for the 3 years remaining on the lease, you are earning income. So it's washing its face and paying your interest costs while you get in place these enhancements, which is the town planning and development permits, so that when you do choose to sell, and you don't have to wait till the end of the 3 years, you might decide to sell 6 months prior to the end of the 3 years, because then the developer coming in inherits the permits that you've obtained. He or she may want to slightly modify them, so that 6 months gives them time to do that. But they can then get their building quotes in place, get all their contractors, so that the day the tenancy ends, they can move straight in and start demolishing, rebuilding, adding, doing whatever is necessary under the terms of the permit. So sometimes it's being able to think outside the box and identifying an opportunity that perhaps others have overlooked, and certainly the current vendor who's selling it has not really appreciated. Now, with a lease expiring, as I said, 3 years is not a long lease, depending on the amount of money you're paying. Obviously, if you're only paying for a property a couple of $100,000, 3 years, it's a good lease. But if you're paying $1 million or $2 million, 3 years is not a good lease. And therefore, it limits the market for the vendor, because most people expending that amount of money want to know that they have a longer-term security than a 2 or 3 year lease, or the period that's remaining on the current lease. So you have the opportunity to, as I said, think outside the square, see an opportunity, and use the time on remaining on the lease to get all your ducks in a row so that you can offer something, a totally new product, to a developer just prior to the lease expiring.
And are there ever times when you able to secure a yield higher than the benchmark for that type of property?
Okay, let's look at the other side of the coin. And we talked about a short lease. We have the opportunity to get a permit, but sometimes you don't have that opportunity and the lease is short. And for the vendor to get the price or to sell the property, they have to effectively compensate you for the uncertainty that exists with you having to take on the responsibility of finding a tenant in, you know, when the lease expires in 12 months' time or 2 years. Sure, the tenant may want to stay on and take a new lease, but they don't know that for certain. And therefore, despite the rent being appropriate, the passing yield may well end up higher than what it normally might because of that compensation factor, that the market's saying to the vendor, look, we're not prepared to pay as much as if it were a five-year lease in place because there is that uncertainty. And most investors are not risk takers. Most of them are passive investors and they want a cash flow. They want more than bank bills and they want some capital growth, but they're not really great risk takers. Now, there are also several other reasons that you might be able to obtain a higher passing yield, but you need to also be aware that these are potential issues that you've got to confront. Now, the first one would be that the rental is actually above market. And when the lease expires, it may be that the tenant decides, even if they have an option to exercise, they might say, well, look, I'm not prepared to exercise my option until you tell me what the rent's going to be and we agree that rent. Now, once we agree the rent, then I'll exercise my option because they know that for whatever reason, the rent they're paying, which might have been escalating automatically on an annual basis, is suddenly shot above the market. Or it mightn't even be sudden. It might have happened over a number of years if it's a longer-term lease. And they know that they want to reset the rent come market review time. So you need to be fully on top of what market rents are so that you don't end up paying market yield on a rent that is above market. Now, the next reason would be that the property itself has been purpose-built. In other words, when it was originally constructed, the tenant was already available and was built for that specific tenant. And it might be that it has a very narrow range of alternative uses. And a lot of my clients often talk about, you know, medical centres and childcare centres, and that's what I call special purpose. And yes, they will give you quite good yields, you know, 8 or 9% net. But what you've got to understand is that both of those uses can operate in a residential zone. Now, if a medical clinic doesn't exercise its option or doesn't continue on the lease, the reason probably is that a newer, better medical clinic has opened up close by and the doctors have migrated across to that because of the new facilities. And this might well be in another 5 or 6 years' time. And the problem you've got is that the way it's been designed, effectively it is an office building for doctors. You can't lease it to office tenants. And I'm even an architect or some other innoxious sort of use, because it's not an office zoning, it's a medical use zoning. So you now have a building and you've paid for a building which, while the doctors were there, was worth every penny, but as soon as they move out, the zoning's residential and therefore you have a problem. But even still, with industrial property, there can be specific things built into an industrial design, pits in the ground, gantry over the top, things like that that not everyone can use or reuse if that tenant leaves. So therefore, you can expect to receive a higher than market yield when you purchase that, or you should, because you carry the risk that if they leave, you've got to solve that problem. And then you come to where some buildings are just obsolete. It's not that they're special purpose. They're just outmoded. It might be as far as security is concerned. It might be the wiring. It might be now people are wanting, you know, five-star green buildings, and this is just antiquated. So it means that when the current tenant leaves, there's going to be some major work required on the property. So again, you're going to want to be compensated for that with a higher yield. Now, the next thing is that the tenant themselves may be financially weak. Now, sometimes that's common knowledge, sometimes it's not. Sometimes a vendor knows that they're having problems with that, and I mean, there are only so many questions you can ask. And under the privacy laws, a lot of things can't be divulged. So sometimes the vendor might well be prepared to offer the market a higher yield, slightly higher yield, because he or she just wants to get rid of the property. They know the headaches they've had, and therefore this is one way of getting rid of the property reasonably quickly. So, you know, it's important that when you're looking at purchasing a property, that you just don't accept the figures given to you at face value. You've got to look behind the figures and get the right advice to make sure that the rent, the tenant, the use, all those things are not such that you should actually demand a higher yield, in other words, a lower price than what the vendor or the market would normally accept for this type of property, because it has these inherent, for want of a better word, impediments that may well come back to bite you down the track.
So how do commercial investors make sense of what's out there?
Well, so I ended up at the end of the last question saying that you just simply can't accept everything at face value and assume that the rent and the lease structure reflect what is market value for that particular property or that particular tenant. And you've got to look at everything. In other words, just looking at comparable sales and saying, these properties are very similar, they sold for such and such, that yield was whatever it was, therefore I apply that yield to my property. If those sales that you're using for comparison themselves reflected market rent, then it's a market yield. But you've got to make sure that the rent in your property is market rent as well and market terms under the lease. So, as I said, you need to look behind every sale and you need to delve deeper than most people are probably capable of doing on the face of it. And it requires, there is a bit of a learning curve, and it's not, as I said, overly complicated. It's a matter of getting to understand the particular type of property that you're looking to purchase and finding out the metrics for that property. And when I'm talking about metrics, I'm talking about rental rates per square meter, selling rates per square meter, all those sort of things, the annual escalations under a lease that's normal for that type of property. And that's probably the reason why I suggest that you don't, when we talked about diversity a couple of weeks ago, that you don't necessarily try and diversify immediately right across every sector, because that requires you to learn a whole lot of new metrics. And they're not going to come overnight, but with the right team in place, you can very quickly absorb and download effectively out of their heads all of the stuff that they've taken years to assemble and amass. And when you ask specific questions, you can get a very quick overview of what's involved. So hopefully that answers your question.
I can now see why you keep coming back to the importance of having your own consulting team in place, because then that allows you to move fast and with certainty.
Yeah, look, as I've probably said before, commercial property is not overly complicated. You simply need to discover the rules and then decide the safest and easiest way for you to enter the game.
Thanks for that, Chris.